He's a surgeon. He's been a cancer patient, and he is a quite brilliant author, Dr. Mohammed Kadra. Good morning to you. The last time you were here, Mohammed, you were talking about a book called Making the Cut, which won a lot of acclaim. The straight-talking surgeon with the warmest of hearts, telling us a few truths about the healthcare system, but also reminding us that this is all about humanity. You've written another book, The Patient, and this is a work of fiction, but then it's not. Would you take us through a little bit? Tell us a little bit about Jonathan Brewster.
Well, Jonathan Brewster, Jeff, is a 49-year-old man. Life is at his feet. You know, his kids are in private schools. He's earning a lot of money. And one morning, he wakes up and pees blood. And from that point, he goes through a journey through the health system, and in a sense is unprepared for the sights, the sounds, the experiences that he'll get. So while it's he himself is a fictionalized character, he's based on four patients that I've had with bladder cancer and their own experiences through the health system.
That was it. I wanted to be reassured that it was a work of fiction, but I know it's been drawn from your own experiences. And I've heard you say that you've written this book because you want patients to better understand what a spell in hospital involves.
Look, I think day in, day out as a surgeon, I sit across the desk from people. I look down at a piece of paper. It might be a biopsy result, maybe a blood test. And that piece of paper translates to the people sitting across the desk from me an incredible change over the next few months, perhaps even a curtailing of their life. And I look into their faces and, you know, some of them are just planning their next holiday. You know, they've just retired. They're planning a cruise. And the irony of sitting across and knowing that they're absolutely unprepared for our health system, they're unprepared individually, financially. Certainly a lot of them are unprepared spiritually and emotionally. Mm. And so I suppose the patient was written as a parable, as a teaching story to try to help patients to better prepare for illness and for the experiences in our health system.
But how well prepared is the system for that patient in the 21st century? And this is sort of the nub of the matter, isn't it?
Well, I think we have seen a deterioration in the health system over the last 10 to 15 years. And the deterioration is not necessarily in terms of the technological wonders that we can create. I mean, we can take a 97-year-old person, put them in ICU, stick all sorts of tubes into them and prolong life for a week or two or a year or two. I think the deterioration has been more in the human connection in terms of compassion. And what is compassion? People often sort of say, look, it's a monopoly of the doctors. It's not. It's actually compassionate when someone greets you in a friendly way when you come to the admissions office or you present to emergency. It's compassionate when you're served with nutritious food. It's compassionate to sit in a bed that is clean and is changed regularly. And so when I wrote Making the Cut, I was inundated with messages from patients who described their own journeys through our hospital. And myself as a patient, it was so eye-opening to me to see the other side of this formula.
What was the most, and I think we probably discussed this last time around, but what was the most profound thing that you noticed? You're the surgeon used to looking down, and then you were the patient looking up. What struck you most dramatically?
Well, I remember the doctor, the surgeon, who was a good friend of mine, sitting across the table and saying, Mohammed, you know that the 5-year survival for the cancer that you have is pretty good. I said, you know, I'm not interested in the 5-year survival. I want to know what the 10-year survival is so that maybe I could see my kids go to high school. I want to know what the 20-year survival is so that maybe I could see them at university, or the 30-year survival, pick up my grandkids. You know, I remember sitting in the bed. I hadn't slept all night. I had headaches. I had pain. And I sort of finally got to bed about 3 o'clock after the nurses had done the various observations. And at 5, the light went on in my room. The door slammed open, and it was the cleaners. And they came in, clattered around, took out the garbage bin, closed the garbage bin, and then went off. to a certain extent, it made me reconsider what it is when we talk about a compassionate system, because it's a system that needs to be compassionate. It's not just the individual doctor or nurse. It's actually the system. When they put food in front of me, I remember it was on a cardboard plate and there was a green plastic tray. And I just ate the mince that was on this cardboard. And next thing I looked down and it's bright green. The bottom of the plate was bright green. What I'd done is eaten through the mince and through the cardboard onto the plastic tray. And I hadn't realized there was a difference in taste.
Did you feel slightly demeaned that the experience, even with a cardboard plate, that it was just another example of your kind of fragility, or that you were a number, or that you were unremarkable?
Unquestionably, I think that, you know, I felt the other end of being the thyroid in bed 3, or the kidney in bed 6, or the liver in bed 8, or that, you know, obstreperous patient in bed 18 who's constantly pressing the buzzer.
Yes.
Rather than being, you know, Mohammed Kadra with two kids, a wife, and even though he's a doctor, incredibly frightened about what the future might bring. And it profoundly changed me for a while. I think I became probably a less effective surgeon as a result, because when I had patients across the desk from me, I could sense, I could feel their pain a lot more than I needed to, a lot more than I should.
Did you also worry about your ability and then the ability of that broader system to be able to provide them with the supports and help that they needed?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a reason why as surgeons we wear a sterile garb. You know, it's not only a barrier against bacteria, but I think it creates a very necessary barrier against the sea of suffering that we see day in, day out. And the challenge for all of us as doctors, as nurses in the health system, is to try to find the balance between giving compassionate health care, being able to make a human connection with an individual in a bed, and at the other side of the coin, not falling into that pool of suffering, so that next day we're able to administer compassion to someone else and someone else. So it is about growing as individuals. And I think, you know, it's only recently that I've been able to recapture that ability.
At 19 minutes past 11, you're listening to Dr. Mohammed Kadra, the author of The Patient and also the book Making the Cut. So if the system is failing us, the patient, at what level is the greatest failure? And could you talk a little bit about that bureaucracy, that bureaucracy that is so anxious about making a mistake that it is almost unable to perform the task that it should perform?
You see, in any corporation, whether it be a school, a university, a hospital, Jeff, there comes a time where at a point in the hierarchy, there switches a view from the micro, which is that I'm dealing with individual patients and I am aware that these people are human beings or customers or students or whatever, and I switch into a macroeconomic view of the corporation that I'm dealing with. And in the health system that was, that point was much, much higher along the hierarchy than it is now. So in the hospitals that we used to have, the nursing unit manager was actually a clinician. She was in charge of the ward, and that person had an enormous amount of power within the ward to hold people to accountability.
Yes.
Whether it was the doctors, the nurses, the cleaners, the catering staff. The first point at which, even if you go up to the matron of the hospital, that person still knew the patient, still knew the problem patients, still interfaced with those patients. The medical superintendent who ran the hospital still had patients. The first point at which it became macroeconomic, in a sense, become sort of my view of health becomes an Excel spreadsheet, was really right up at the health department. Now what we have is that point is descending downwards. So even local managers, even the nursing unit manager in a ward, actually needs to have Excel spreadsheets in front of that person,
yes,
and views the ward as an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah.
These are the separations I've had. These are the DRGs. This is the budget that I've had.
Yeah.
This is the budget I don't have. And fundamentally, I think what the bureaucracy needs to understand is that if we want to come into budget, what we need to do is empower individual hospitals to make decisions. Their approach over the last 10 to 15 years has been, let us bring unto us the power, so centralize the power because the health budget's going out of is running away from us. And the reason why it's running away is because there isn't local accountability.
Yes.
There aren't decisions done locally about even end-of-life issues, about rationalizing the health dollar in a sensible way.
The decision-making seems to be taking place further and further and further away from the place where the decisions really have to be made.
I mean, we all working in the hospitals feel absolutely disempowered.
And yet, when you wrote Making the Cut, which won a lot of acclaim, and you were, I wonder if you were saying things that people thought but weren't saying, or whether you were seen to be particularly brave as a surgeon to come out and say, this is what's bloody wrong. How confident are you this time round that there is the enthusiasm to support that kind of idea, to take the decision-making away from the authority, to not make the whole business of the hospital so anxious about error? You know, can you get the health minister? Can you get Nicola Roxon on board? Is she interested? And what do you think you can do?
Well, a few weeks ago I thought maybe what we need is, instead of a clinical excellence commission or any other form of commission, perhaps what we require is a compassion commission in the health department, one that might actually train the frontline staff about how to deal with patients, how to create a patient journey that is positive, that is not negative. See, if you talk to patient advocate groups, they're not happy. If you talk to the nurses, they're not happy. The doctors aren't happy. Even the individual bureaucrats themselves, many of whom go to work feeling, I need to make a change. But they're aware that if they make a decision and it's a mistake, then they'll lose their job.
Yes.
So the easiest thing for a bureaucrat is
to become risk-averse.
You know, I won't make a decision.
Yeah.
So if I'm, in the hospital where I work in Sydney, if I require a new instrument to conduct the operations I do, I need to write a business plan.
Mm.
And that business plan goes up. It certainly can't be decided at my hospital because the general manager has a delegation that's only about $50. The person runs a $150 million budget, but his delegation is $50.
Yeah.
So it needs to go into the New South Wales Health Department or the West Australian Health Department. The decision-making there is ferried and shot from side to side because nobody wants to actually put their signature to the bottom of the requisition because they're too scared. If I've made a mistake, then I'm going to lose my job. And fundamentally, what the health minister needs to do, and you know, the New South Wales health minister, he's a very sincere person.
Mm-hmm.
Your health minister is a very sincere person. But what they need to do is to say, listen, if you make a mistake, you won't lose your job.
Yes.
But if you have inactivity, you will lose your job. If you don't make decisions, if you don't actually improve something over the next 3 months, you will lose your job.
If you're not motivated by determination to keep the ball rolling in the direction it should be rolling,
exactly,
that's the basis upon which we will judge you, not for having made an error of judgment.
Right. And then I think the second vital side of that argument is to trust once again individual hospital management.
Mm.
Set them targets, set them goals, but try not to micromanage, because each hospital has individual requirements. There are resources within each hospital. There are strengths, there are weaknesses. And it's only the local staff, the doctors and nurses and clinicians working in these hospitals, that are best able to judge, best able to manage their own circumstances.
You're listening to Dr. Mohamed Kadra. This will be our podcast. I'm delighted. I know, I knew it always would be our podcast for today. If you go to abc.net.au/Perth, the podcast of this will be there in a little while. You also make a point, because this is about building better relationships between patients, doctors, patients, and something our friend on this program, Dr. Norman Swan, says a lot, that if you're dealing with a doctor who isn't communicating with you properly, who doesn't let you be part of this decision-making process, who sits on the other side of that table and says, Mohammed, this is the five-year plan, shop around, because we're still very frightened too, aren't we?
Look, I think every competent doctor welcomes patients who are well-informed. Mm. And fundamentally, I think the view that the health system is there as a benevolent force, you know, nuns gliding through the wards, is no longer the case. It's a health system predicated on a lot of fragmentation. You know, a person coming in after a car crash can have 10 departments in the hospital looking after them. And the only person left to really be an advocate for the patient is the patient and their own family and friends. And so my you know, recommendation to any patient is ask questions. Why are you treating me in this way? What is the treatment? What are the alternatives? What are the risks of this treatment? What are the risks of not giving me this operation? Mm. And, you know, there's... I think we would be naive not to realize that there is an inherent conflict of interest in health. One of the conversations I have with my patients is, look, I see here you have a prostate cancer. You need an operation. I need to declare a conflict of interest. If you have the operation, I get paid. Mm. If you don't have the operation, I don't get paid. Having said that, here is my advice and these are the reasons for it. Now, you know, some of my colleagues think I'm mad declaring this conflict of interest, but, you know, I'm a fellow of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. If I was sitting on a company where my advice gave me personal gain and my lack of advice gave me, you know, loss, I would certainly have to declare that to a board.
Yes.
Why don't I declare it to my patient?
We began this interview with you introducing us to Jonathan Brewster, a man with the world at his feet who's got bladder cancer. To finish today, what's the prognosis for blokes like Jonathan in Australia, for anyone about to go into hospital?
Let me say that, and I say this in the author's note, bladder cancer is a very treatable and curable condition. But I sought to, you know, about 10 to 15% of patients don't have such a straightforward pathway. And of course, Jonathan was one of those. The four patients on whom Jonathan was based and all the experiences in the patient were true patients, and each of the experiences he goes through actually are true experiences.
Do you have a fair amount of faith that compassion has a place and is not just going to be a word that's used in 21st century medicine, that it's a word that we understand better?
I think we, as human beings, we have to have faith that compassion is going to be part of our health system. And, you know, I think we need to have conversations about how we can die better. The health system, I think, has become a place which worships the lengthening of life, and I'm much more about worshipping the quality of life.
It's been great to talk to you, Dr. Mohammed Kadra. Thank you very much for coming in.
Jeff, thank you so much.